We're learning about a new anthology that calls upon the lived experiences of Black Americans in the Midwest. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a collection of poetry and prose and photography with almost 50 contributors. Approximately 7 million people who identify as African American live in the Midwest. And at this moment of reckoning, the Black Midwest could be the beacon for the rest of the country. Jamala Rogers wrote that in the foreword. Let the nation know the Fresh Coast is rising. The Fresh Coast, an expression of elevating the Midwest as an equal to the overshadowing coasts of the East and West. What is it like for you to grow up in the middle, a Black Midwesterner? We're at 800-642-1234. Tarian L. Williamson is the editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. She's an associate professor of African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota and director of the Black Midwest Initiative. She's from Peoria. Tarian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, let's start with your story with Peoria and what you decided to write about with your roots and your hometown. And one of the things you note about Peoria that really as echoes where we are here in Wisconsin, that it was designated this all-American city a number of times, but it's also been designated as one of the worst cities for African Americans in the nation. What do you make of that discrepancy in Peoria and other cities like Milwaukee and Minneapolis?
Yeah, it's a sort of amazing thing, right? And I think it's in some ways it's a minor thing, but it's also actually something that can tell us something really important about, you know, what it is to be Black in the middle, what it is to be Black in general, and how the sort of nation state functions, right? So, you know, Peoria, Illinois has been named again and again and again on this list, that this annual list that comes out every year of the sort of quote unquote worst cities to be Black. And this list is cultivated by way of looking at disparities between Black and white residents across the number of measures, including income, incarceration rates, levels of education, home ownership rates. And I think Peoria has been on that list every single year since it's been coming out. But yes, at the same time, it shows up, it gets this sort of All America City Award, which is about sort of civic engagement. And it's sort of celebrating what the city has done in relationship to sort of its people, right? And so the same thing happens where I am now. So the Black Midwest Initiative is based at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities. I live in Minneapolis, and a similar type of thing happens with Minneapolis. Last year, Minneapolis and St. Paul, which are combined the Twin Cities, showed up as number 4 on the list of worst places to be Black, but showed up, I think, as number 6, or it's at least in the top 10 of like best of the top 125 cities to live. And so it feels like that sort of discrepancy says a lot about what it is to be Black in this country.
It's
how
like
can these things exist together? Yeah,
it's like there are two cities. There's a Peoria,
exactly.
And then there's another Peoria. It's like the shadow. So when you talk about the Black Midwest Initiative, what is it and how did you get it started?
The Black Midwest Initiative started in 2017. It is something I had been thinking about since I started doing my own work on Peoria as in grad school, but really came into formation in 2017 in the wake of the election, the presidential election of 2016. And part of the intention was to speak to the vacuum of Black folks writing about Black and talking about Black experiences in the Midwest. And I guess let me clean that up a little bit. Black folks have been talking about their experiences in the Midwest. Mm. Black people have been doing art. Black people have been doing their own sort of informal studying about what it is to be Black here. But it's as if the sort of narrative, the media narrative, is as if we did not exist. So part of what the initiative is doing is creating a platform in which we're highlighting the work that researchers are doing, as well as the work that artists are doing and the work that community organizers are doing to speak to the conditions of our lives. And I think it's very important that we are a Black organization speaking on behalf of ourselves as Black people in this region. And that's sort of our main or sort of organizing mission and function.
So when you put out the call for submissions for this work, what did you find out about that call? How was it received?
It was received well, and I guess I should also say that the anthology, so we both put out an open call, and it came after the first symposium that we held on the campus of the University of Minnesota in October of last year. Mm. So a number of the people who contributed to Black in the Middle were also people who contributed at the symposium itself, maybe about half of the contributors. And then we put out a broader call to people across the region. And people were really like, I think people felt much like I have felt, and so many of us who are involved with the Black Midwest Initiative, like finally, here is something that's going to speak to what we have been experiencing, and we get to do it collectively. So I get to see, you know, my work up against the work of someone from a different place in the region, but who has also had similar kinds of experiences. And that has been really wonderful.
Oh, you can see some through lines then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tarian Williamson, editor of Black in the Middle. It's an anthology of the Black Midwest. That's the subtitle there. She's an associate professor of African-American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota and director, as we've been talking about, the Black Midwest Initiative, originally from Peoria. You can join in on what it feels like for you growing up in the Midwest, living here now. Are you Black in the Midwest? What is that like for you? And what stories can you share? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. As you were putting the writing and the essays together and the compilation of art and photography, Tarian, were there particular goals you had in mind in putting together this mix of voices, voices that have been suppressed for so long?
Well, what I wanted to do with the anthology is also similar to the way we arranged the symposium, which is there were sort of really broad categories. So, for instance, the first subheading that you get in the book is home. And the idea was to bring together people across various kinds of work. So what do poets have to say about home? And what do sort of people who are researching from within academic settings, as well as people who are public intellectuals, as well as artists, how do they all sort of respond to how are they all thinking through the idea of home, for instance? And so really the idea was to show the breadth of work that is happening within the Midwest. It was meant to both highlight cities like Chicago and Detroit, sort of the cities that, to the extent that people think about Black folks in the Midwest, that those larger cities become the ones that people think about most often, but also a place like Sumter Township in Michigan, and also places like Flint and Gary and Peoria, for instance, these smaller places that don't get thought about as much, to highlight and hold together all these various places where we find ourselves and the various sort of multiple ways that we speak to the conditions of our existence.
I want to go back to your essay about growing up in Peoria, and you write about the city's most famous resident, the comedian Richard Pryor. What did you see there? What did you find in Pryor's comedy that either resonated or just turned you off?
You know, the funny thing is that, you know, I grew, one of the things I talk about in my essay is growing up in a pretty Christian household, one in which Richard Pryor didn't show up very much. Richard Pryor was sort of the antithesis of the kinds of things that my parents were teaching me. But once I left Peoria, and the point of interaction for people with Peoria, when I would say I was from there, particularly Black folks of a certain generation would be like, oh, that's where Richard Pryor is from. And initially, as a college, as you know, an 18, 19, 20 year old college student, it was like, what is the deal with all this conversation about Richard Pryor? But as I got older, I came to appreciate more and more of what of Richard Pryor's commentary. And part of what I'm speaking to in that piece is the way that for all of the way that Peoria itself tried to hold itself apart from Richard Pryor, and for all of his sort of debaucherous comedy or whatever it may be, what was sort of great is this way that people always sort of thought about Richard Pryor in relationship to Peoria, which is to say that for as much as he critiqued Peoria, he always critiqued Peoria. He also understood it as this place that he couldn't hold himself apart from. He was always talking about it in a way that was, this is my people and my place, even if it's jacked up in some fundamental ways.
Tarian Williamson edited a new anthology. We're talking about it. Black in the Middle brings together voices, what it means to be Black in the Midwest. We'll be back in a minute with her right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring a new book of essays and poetry, photography that put the experiences of Black Midwesterners front and center. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. The anthology Black in the Middle has dozens of contributors, including UW-Milwaukee political scientist Gladys Mitchell Wathauer, who writes, Black women in Milwaukee create spaces of resistance in their homes and communities by surviving in a city where death and dying is a part of the lived Black experience. Her essay is about Black mothers trying to feed their families. What is your experience growing up as a Black Midwesterner? Do you have Midwest roots and live elsewhere now? Why did you leave and under what circumstances would you move back? It's 800-642-1234. Tarian Williamson edited the anthology and she stays with us. Tarian, I want to take a deeper dive there into the essay titled Trying to Make a Dollar Out of 15 Cents in Black Milwaukee and what Gladys is getting at there as she looks at SNAP benefits. What can you explain through her essay?
What I think is really important about what Gladys is doing is she's talking about so she's using this sort of theoretical concept of social death to think about what's happening to Black folks, specifically in Milwaukee. This idea that as a consequence of the lived realities of Black people, that there's a kind of that the life we're living is one that if not technically dead, if you're not technically dead, you're socially dead, which is to say you live a life that's sort of precariously close to death at all times. And she's talking about this, and that I will say is a sort of contested idea, but one that is really being rigorously thought through in Black studies in the academy and beyond the academy, right?
But that word necropolitics.
Yeah, necropolitics, yeah. And thinking about it in relationship to another word that is buzzing about Afro-pessimism, for instance. And so she's thinking through those ideas by way of Black women who are SNAP beneficiaries, right, who are getting government assistance, and using that as a lens by which to think about how Black women, poor Black women survive in the city of Milwaukee and all the various sort of alternative strategies of survival that they have, even in a context in which they're often precariously close to death or to physical death or a slow death by way of poverty.
What does she find? Because she interviews Black women and asks them about what they have done to be able to put food on the table.
Yeah, and they talk about, robbing Peter to pay Paul. They talk about different sort of alternative, so like borrowing from people, right? It's interesting that part of what comes up, I think, it seems like I remember happening in one of the women talks about, I didn't have to prostitute myself, but I might have had to do a whole bunch of other things in order to be able to survive. And my own work, actually, part of the work that I'm doing now is actually about Black women who have been victims of serial murder, who often have been involved at many times in prostitution. And so we can think about these as various mechanisms of survival that Black women engage in, and that we have to disengage from. And I think part of what I see Gladys getting at is that we have to disengage from morality arguments and think about how the sort of socioeconomic conditions of Black people in cities like Milwaukee sort of create the conditions of possibility for people to be involved in all kinds of alternative mechanisms for survival, whether it be theft, whether it be prostitution, whether it be, borrowing from other people, all sorts of different ways, whether it's sort of being part of underground economies, from doing hair on the side in one's living room to selling drugs to whatever kind of underground economies that people might be involved in. There's all sorts of ways in which people engage in this work in order to be able to make to survive.
We're talking with Terrian Williamson, who is the editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. And we're looking at the voices in this anthology, the stories, the essays, and your insights on what it is like to be a Black Midwesterner. We're at 800-642-1234. Terrian, this essay as well, echoes that idea that we talked about earlier, cities being ranked as the worst places for African Americans to live, which Milwaukee has been, and talking about all these inequities that we know are present in Milwaukee, the high Black infant mortality rate, the poor state of public schools for Black children, the high poverty. And then she says that surviving in such a place is an act of political resistance. Mm-hmm. What does that mean there?
I think she's saying that, we often, especially at this moment, we think of resistance often in really particular kinds of ways. What it means to, when we think about political resistance, we think of it as being one of those folks who's out on the streets holding a placard. We think of it as people being involved in really particular kinds of protest movements, for instance. But what she's suggesting here is that when you live in a context such as what's happening to folks, to Black folks in Milwaukee and so many other places throughout the region, that what it is, what it is to talk about sort of political resistance is simply survival. So survival itself is a mechanism of protest. It's a mechanism of political resistance because it requires so much for one to survive. And often those same kinds of alternative things that people are involved in that we were talking about earlier sort of force us to think differently about the kinds of socio-political engagements that we have. What does it mean to sort of sell your SNAP benefits to someone on the side? What does that tell us about the government and how it functions? How is that itself a protest against the sort of normative operations of the government, right? Like even the ways in which people exist in their day-to-day lives is a way of thinking about what political resistance is on the ground.
We heard from Pierre in La Crosse, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Pierre says that one of the biggest issues about being Black in the Midwest is the lack of mental health services from mm-hmm. Black service providers. And Pierre wanted to add that comment about, the reflection of not having people of color in service providers in the mental health area. What can you say there?
I think that's of absolute critical importance, what Pierre is bringing up. And it's particularly important if you think about the kinds of things we're talking about, the book, you think about what Gladys is talking about. When you are living in conditions in which on every side, you're bound in by precarity, when every day you're struggling to survive, when you're trying to figure out how you're going to feed your children, when you are also economically anxious, to use some of the language that gets used in relationship to some other folks, for instance, that takes a mental health toll on people, right? And while sort of mental health services are desperately needed for all kinds of communities of color, I think thinking about the necessity of that in relationship to the deep sort of socioeconomic struggles that Black people are having within this region is of critical importance. It has to be part of that sort of political protest and negotiation that is yet ongoing.
This book comes at such an important time in our history as we look at the protests and racial inequality and the systemic racism and really diving deeper into this issue that has been with us all along. When you brought this book forward, what was the timing there with the, with Black Lives Matter and with the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer?
It's really interesting because, you know, we had been planning this book before we had our symposium, which was, as I mentioned earlier, last October, so October 2019. I put the finishing touches on the book and sent it off to the press at the end of February of this year. And so a few weeks later is when everything started getting shut down because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few weeks after that, at the end of May, was when George Floyd was killed. And then the uprisings began. And then you have also after that, you had what happened in Kenosha. And so it was just really interesting that we had been doing this work. We had been doing this work in the book, but the Black Midwest Initiative had been trying to speak. It's like we could have told y'all something like this was going to happen, and that there are so many Black Midwestern communities that are like that are one event, one incident away from there being yet another uprising because the conditions are just so precarious in our communities. And so the book really just happened to come out right as all of this was happening. And so there is a coda in the book at the very end that the press let me slip in right at the end before the book went to press that I wrote, I think in June, which is trying to speak to that. Like we never could have imagined all that would have happened to create the necessity for the words that are that show up in this book.
Yeah.
But that I think many of us as contributors, like we're not surprised that it would happen here. You know.
Right. University of Minnesota professor Terrian Williamson edited the new book called Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. It grew out of her Black Midwest Initiative in 2017. Black Wisconsinites, Midwesterners, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite thing about living in Middle America? What do you hate about the Midwest? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Terrian Williamson right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Terrian Williamson of the University of Minnesota. She's curated a collection of essays and poetry and photography about what it means to be Black in the Midwest. It's called Black in the Middle. It was released by Belt Publishing, which is a small press in Cleveland that focuses on works from the Rust Belt and the Midwest. What are your reflections of growing up Black in the Midwest? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in perspective on that with Nikki in Delavan. Hi, Nikki. Hi, Nikki. Are you there? Hi, Nikki.
Hello?
Hi. Yeah, go ahead.
There we are.
Sure.
I was calling because the conversation really struck heart to heart.
Oh, my goodness.
Chicago. We moved to Milwaukee when I was about 7. I'm 28 years old now. And I was telling the producer, you know, for me, it was surviving the opposite of the stereotypes. Because, of course, being African-American and especially being a woman, we are stereotypical to be on welfare and to have assistance from government and whoever else that we can get help from. And for me, it was the complete opposite. You know, I was born to a teenage mom. She was actually 14 when she had me. And so I made that a goal, especially being a Christian and staying in church, to try to stay abstinent and keep my faith with me. That has also helped me survive and become the person that I am today. I don't have kids at this moment. I'm 28 years old. I've never actually benefited from government assistance. I've worked 2 to 3 jobs my entire life since I was 18 years old just to try to stay independent and so that people couldn't, you know, point the finger and say that you fall into this role. But I also got the opposite from my family, some of my cousins, you know, everybody looks at me and looks down on me and thinks that I'm stuck up because I'm not this way or I do my own thing. And it's sort of hard to try to balance that, and I don't know how to explain it.
how do you respond when you get those stereotypical comments, or when you feel like you're being put in a particular box that you should not be in?
That's the best part about being who I am as well. I've gotten to work with a lot of different people in a lot of different places. Again, coming from Chicago, being raised and working in Milwaukee, and now working in Delavan, I've grown to actually learn how to have a real conversation and explain in my ways and why I do the things that I do with people. And whether they understand or they don't, I feel better knowing that it didn't, develop into an argument or a debate, because that's something I do not do, especially with religion and politics. I've been able to converse with people because of my attitude and my demeanor, my aura that I give out. Some people can recognize that, white, black, Hispanic, it does not matter. I've been able to just explain my way, but also listen to other people and what they have to say and why they feel the way that they do.
Terry, and jump in here on what Nikki is saying and being able to have grown to have these real difficult conversations with people around her.
Yeah, I really appreciate Nikki's comment. And I think the piece that we were talking about earlier, Gladys's piece, sort of speaks to this, because one of the things that Gladys talks about is how she's a professor and she's she's sort of staunchly middle class, yet she is still also dealing with the same kinds of stereotypes. That stereotyping occurs regardless of where you land on the sort of the class spectrum. And we're always trying to push against that. And I think regardless of perhaps, like in the case of Nikki has never had to use governmental assistance. Nikki has been able to have certain kinds of rich, robust conversations with people. Whether one is able to do that or whether one sort of life occurs very differently, those stereotypes, we're always constantly pushing with and against those. And I think there's another kind of conversation to also have about the necessity of governmental assistance and what government owes communities that have been completely under-resourced and abandoned, particularly within the region, and the way that deprivationist policies have created the conditions of possibility for us, for so many Black folks to be poor and be struggling in the ways in which they are. So I really appreciate Nikki's insight there.
Nikki, thank you so much for calling and bringing your perspective and also what you've experienced. Rodney now in Madison is with us. Hi, Rodney.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I guess my question is, how do we teach our kids the etiquette to move on from poverty? I grew up in Madison. I grew up in Seattle, Washington. In 2004, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, not knowing, it was the most beautiful place to stay or live at that time. Unfortunately, I didn't know the poverty of Milwaukee and how most Black men were locked up in the United States in Milwaukee. But I guess, where do we move on from here? And how do we teach our kids to have the proper etiquette and, I guess, psychology to know that, somebody might say something negative, but you still have to feel that you belong. When you walk into a store or a restaurant, you still have to feel like you belong, even though that some people may not wave at you or look at you like you feel like you don't belong. You have to teach our kids to move on. And it's not, growing up in Seattle, I was fortunate enough to have a lot of white friends and a lot of Black friends. And I grew up, I wasn't middle class, but my mom, I grew up Southern, but my mom had the mentality, you have to work for what you want. And I don't see that in a lot of our kids coming up today. It's like everything has to be handed to them. So,
Tarian, what do you say there?
I guess I would say that while I take the point that's being made, I also think that etiquette will not save us. I don't think, good behavior will save us. I understand the point, the sort of larger point about which sort of mobilizes around the idea of personal responsibility. And I'm not suggesting that there's not some of that that's necessary. But in addition to sort of teaching our youth about proper protocols, I think, You know, for me, what I do as a teacher, as an instructor, it's also about teaching the kind of structural violences and inefficiencies which allow for the conditions under which we live. That I personally don't buy into a narrative of Black pathology, that the reason that we end up here is because we won't get our stuff together. I don't buy into that narrative. And so consequently, I think that the response and the answer has to be bigger than telling people how they ought to, teaching people how we think they ought to behave. But it's also about putting pressure in the ways that we see a lot of people within community putting pressure on government and on people with power to do better by our communities. That to me seems really essential.
Holding elected leaders accountable for actually Absolutely. Putting the reforms in place, getting those reforms passed, and then putting them into action.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Terrianne Williamson, editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest, and sharing your experiences as well at 800-642-1234. Terrianne, I want to look at the essay by Tamara Winfrey Harris called Stop Pretending Black Midwesterners Don't Exist. And Tamara writes in, or it could be Tamara, I'm not sure the pronunciation of her name, but in the minds of many Americans, the region where I have lived all my life is synonymous with whiteness. And then pointing out that there are more Black Midwesterners than there are Black Americans on the East or West Coast. Where does this notion come from that the Midwest is super white?
That's a good question. You know, when I moved to Minnesota from Michigan, you know, the first thing people would always say is, oh, it's cold there. And then after they told me about how cold it was like, are there actually Black people there? And it's like, it turns out, yes, there are. All right. And so there's all of these states and cities that have been coded as all white. And I think part of that has to do with sort of major media outlets tend to be based on the coast. And as I mentioned earlier, to the extent that we talk about Black people in the Midwest, we sort of think of them as being in cities like Detroit and Chicago. Mm-hmm. But it's thought that life worth living happens in the major cities, and there aren't that many, you know, really large cities in the Midwest. And so, and the sort of common sense around places, states like Iowa and Michigan and Wisconsin, for instance, is that they are these very white places. But also what's happening is that Black people are very much, although there are rural Black folks, Black people are very much based in the cities. So you have like the blacker cities and then the whiter suburbs, and you have that happening quite a bit as well. And so a state like Minnesota is predominantly white, but then you have Black folks who are really sort of segregated in very particular pockets of the state. So I think that might be part of it as well. But there's just this long-standing narrative of the middle of the Midwest being and flyover country because it's not cosmopolitan enough, because it's not diverse enough. And in actuality, we're here. It's just about telling different kinds of stories about what we're doing here.
Well, the narrative has been seemingly so focused on violence or on right. Criminal headlines and all of these other stories get shoved by the wayside.
Exactly. And part of what I hope we're doing with Black in the Middle is, on the one hand, while it is important for us to highlight the various issues that we are up against, what we're also trying to do is celebrate what makes life livable here as well. We're also trying to celebrate the richness of the region and talk about the fact that, like, many of us are not fleeing. So there's the narrative now that we're hearing about reverse migration, which is real. Like, reverse migration is happening, you know, Black folks moving back south and that sort of thing. But it's also the case that many of us are staying here and we're, you know, fighting for our communities and we're doing really important work in our communities. And that's also something that we really think is important to highlight, both with the Black Midwest Initiative and in Black in the Middle.
Carrion Williamson edited the new anthology Black in the Middle. We're discussing the complexities of Black people's lives in the Midwest, especially at this moment of reckoning with protests against systemic racism and police brutality. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we explore the new anthology called Black in the Middle. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Dozens of contributors bring these deeply personal observations, bittersweet truths about being Black in the Midwest. Here is an excerpt from Kitiakis King Carroll, a doctoral candidate at the University of Minnesota. Kitiakis writes, "When I think of spades in my childhood in Milwaukee, I remember the abundance of fried fish, spaghetti, and brown liquor that took the form of Crown Royal, Canadian Club, or Hennessy. And you might also have a can of Milwaukee's best, Miller or Old Milwaukee, and you would play as if your life depended on it. And if you don't know how to play spades, then you don't know how to play spades." What are your reflections of growing up Black in the Midwest? It's 800-642-1234. The anthology's editor, Tarian Williamson, stays with us. Let's take another call now. John is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Yeah, go ahead.
I listen to you guys every day. I'm a truck driver in Wisconsin. I just wanted to kind of talk about Midwest experience. I'm from born in Detroit, and again, one of the most segregated cities. Like she was talking about worst place for Black people, but I think it was like number one best place to live. So I was raised by a single mom. She has a master's degree. Can't get a job. Black woman. And so I moved here to Wisconsin to. Me and my son and my family, and I love it up here. I love the peacefulness, the opportunity, but at the same time, it's hard being everywhere I go. I'm the only Black guy at my job, and then I always have to defend or explain stuff. It's just difficult sometimes, and that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, John, thank you so much for bringing that. And there was a little difficult crackly there. But John, saying it is difficult for him and his son to be the only Black person in the room, or, you know, and just being a bit of that outsider feeling in his own community that he loves deeply.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think many of us in the Midwest can absolutely feel for what John is saying, and whether it's in our work life, whether it's in our home life, that's part two of why I think the initiative exists, why it's important for us to talk more about tell the kinds of stories we're trying to tell, because it's also about finding each other. Like, we're here, but part of it is like, where are our people at? So coming from Detroit to Wisconsin, where does John need to go to find the people with whom he can better engage, and find the communities, the places in which he can be in community? Because it is definitely, you know, struggling with what you're struggling with already and then feeling sort of isolated is par for the course for many of us as well.
I really struggled with him saying that his mother having a master's degree has really struggled, and that just doesn't seem right at all.
Right, because you do the things that you're told you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to get an education. You're supposed to do all of these things. But part of the kind of data that we're seeing come out tells us that even Black people who, this sort of goes back to one of the earlier conversations, even if you're doing all the things you're supposed to do, even if you have the proper etiquette, even if you're going, getting your education, you can still find yourself in a situation in which you're struggling to survive. And it's that much deeper for people of color and for Black folks within this region. Like the statistics around that are just that much deeper.
I read that excerpt from Kitiakis King Carroll about the spades, and I want to talk a little bit about this essay on spades, queerness, and the things we learn from our grandmothers. A deep, fond remembrance of the grandmother in this essay, and how much she taught about the world, and even and the playing of the card game Spades. Uh-huh. What did you see in this essay?
I think so. Kitty Ockes is actually a student I work with. This is an amazing student from Milwaukee. And I think what's so critical about the story Kitty Ockes is telling is that this, so we're living, we're talking about the sort of under-resourced communities that we come from. We're talking about what it is to be from under-resourced places, deprivationist policies. Kitty Ockes knows about that. But what Kitty Ockes also knows is that the places where you can find joy, celebration, the places where you can learn the deepest lessons in life. He's a doctoral candidate. He will soon be Dr. Kitty Ockes King Carroll. Mm. Yet some of the most important, critical, significant, life-changing, life-altering lessons he has learned have been from his grandmother sitting at around the table, sitting around playing spades with his grandmother and other family members as they drank brown liquor, right? And so many of us can attest to that, right? And so many of us, you know, to go back to John's point about sort of finding your place and your people, often these kinds of places, the places of home, the places of sort of intramural community become so important for how we stay grounded and how we stay alive, even in the context of all we struggle against.
Terrianne Williamson, editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. We're talking about it. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Terrianne, we've gotten all the way into this conversation, haven't mentioned anything about the poetry in this anthology. And there's one piece by Brian G. Gilmore that looks that has Prince and Philando Castile in mm-hmm. the title. Can you introduce us to this piece?
So what's really cool about this piece of Brian's, it's called The Negro in Minneapolis for Prince and Philando Castile. That piece is from a larger collection of his that came out in 2019 called Come See About Me, Marvin. And it's essentially a kind of dialogue between Gilmore and Marvin Gaye, both of whom are from D.C., but then ended up for professional reasons getting transplanted to the Midwest. So what that essay is specifically talking about Minneapolis, but this sort of part of a series of poems about like how to be here, you know, what it means to be uprooted from another place and end up here, and the things that one sees as a consequence of that. So part of what Black in the Middle is also doing is it's not just people like me who were born and raised in the Midwest and Kitty Ockes, right, but also people like Brian who came here from another place, and through by way of the sort of rich, beautiful language of his poetry, is able to say something about what it means to sort of take the lay of the land as someone who was transplanted here. And that he makes this sort of rich analogy between Prince and Philando Castile. You know, we talk about there not being Black folks here.
But, and Philando Castile, the Black man who was shot and killed by a police officer at a traffic stop in 2016, right, in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Right. And thinking about a sort of correlation between those Black men in a city like Minneapolis, which is critical to what he's doing there.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, what is the Black Midwest Initiative up to now? What are you working on?
We have a number of things going on. If people want to find out more information about what we're doing in our platform, or they want to join in our work, you can find out more at theblackmidwest.com. One of the things we're really excited about that we'll be doing very soon is launching our first scholarship. It's called the David C. Smith Scholarship Fund. And that scholarship will be meant specifically for community college students. And it's named after a young Black man who was killed 10 years before George Floyd in Minneapolis under very similar kinds of circumstances. And you can find out more about David's life and that scholarship fund at our website. And we're also preparing for our next symposium, which will be held, if all things go, you know, depending on COVID, mm-hmm. we're planning for it to be held in the spring of 2022 at Wayne State University in Detroit. So folks should be on the lookout for that as well.
Terrianne, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Tarian Williamson, she is the editor of Black in the Middle, an anthology of the Black Midwest. It's published by Belt Publishing in Cleveland. Just ahead, it is 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.